Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 76, which I recorded when I was in Zurich. I happened to visit Disney Research in Zurich, and I sat down with Pascal Bérard and Thabo Bieler, who was there. Unfortunately, Derek Bradley was supposed to be with us as well, but he had a meeting conflict, so he couldn't join us. But it was an absolutely amazing.
Yeah, you get to go to all the cool places.
I do. I'm very, very lucky that I got to hang out with them because these guys are really super, super smart. They are all members of the Digital Human League, and we talked a lot about our ideas of where we want to move forward on Digital Human League and figured we might as well do a podcast and share as much with you guys as possible. It's a very technical one, very academic one. Also just really overall cool. So I hope you really enjoy it. I loved doing it. And I loved seeing Zurich. Zurich was really cool. We ended up talking a lot about Swiss culture in the beginning of it, which
did,
I think was
did
cool.
You open a Swiss bank account while you were there just in case?
Just in case? No, I did not do that. And I didn't buy any Swiss Army knives. Although strangely, you can buy a Swiss Army knife at the airport after you pass security. Well,
interesting.
just a thought, you know, just thinking.
Okay.
Yeah. But anyway, I really love Switzerland. It's, you know, it's gorgeous. But it's a completely different world, really. It's just its own, it's its own microcosm in a lot of ways. And I also did visited a couple other places there, so we'll see that. A couple of announcements we should do. We put out finally, a lot of people have been asking, we told people we're working on the guide to GPU rendering, and we finally put it out there.
It's flying off the virtual shelves right now.
It is. A lot of people have downloaded it. We're getting some pretty good positive feedback. But I would love to hear more from you guys and hear what you guys think, what you'd like to see more of. And if you'd like to see more of these kind of guides, definitely let us know. We'd love to be able to help you guys out on other areas. I think it's a good area for us to get into to help people out.
If you haven't downloaded it, check it out. Go to labs.chaosgroup.com.
Yep. And it's right there in the projects area. And you can see the projects area has guide to GPU. You just download it. It's pretty big, 61 pages. So it's a big long PDF. And Vlado took some of them with him to EUEDIS when he went to...
Yeah, he's in Utrecht right now at EUE.
Yep.
Man, that's a great conference.
Yeah, I want to go.
Just talking CG in a pub is basically, I mean, that's a perfect place to do podcast.
Yeah, I know. There you go.
See?
There you go. I should go to Utrecht next.
Once again,
next
you get to go to all the cool places.
Yep, that's a really cool one. And other events coming up, we got SIGGRAPH coming up.
It's coming up fast.
Yeah.
You know, month away.
It is a month away.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, so
maybe a little bit more than a month away, but it's coming up quick.
Okay,
planning on V-Ray days. Still working on a roster of speakers.
Yep.
From around the globe.
We're doing a couple days, right?
Of V-Ray days. Yep. Yeah. Presentations on latest feature films, movies, and television shows.
Uh-huh.
I think we're gonna have Lotto do a kind of a tech talk, similar to what he's doing at EUE, because he's sharing a lot of really cool breakthrough stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to have an educator's breakfast. So there's a new V-Ray for Maya training materials out, and we're going to have some people in to talk about that.
Yep.
It should be a good time.
Good.
And then a party, which we haven't settled on a venue.
Yeah, we'll have a
there,
get together.
There will be a mixer.
A mixer of some kind.
Somewhere.
Yep. So we'll let you guys know about that when we know more about it, but it'll be fun. So hopefully you guys will meet us at SIGGRAPH. There's a bunch of, you know, right before this week, just before I went on vacation. By the way, sorry I didn't do any podcasts for 2 weeks, but, you know, I needed a vacation, guys. I needed a little bit of a break. So hopefully you guys can catch up to some of the old podcasts that you had missed in the past. But we're back now. Trust me, the podcast has not gone away.
There's one more thing about SIGGRAPH I almost forgot.
What?
We've got a paper in there.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, the guys have the Stochastic Flakes paper. They're going to be doing a presentation on it.
Yep.
And that was a pretty big deal because that was the first one that the guys have ever submitted, and it got accepted. So
yep.
If you're looking to create some really interesting glittery materials like car paints or like a 1970s bowling ball, it's pretty cool.
Or if you're in the bass boat business. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, it's really, really cool. Actually, there's a lot of really great stuff. I mean, V-Ray 3.4 just came out not too long ago, and it's already getting huge stuff. Yep. The denoiser is...
Max and Maya.
The denoiser is a big thing. Everyone's going crazy.
We could not
that.
Avoid the come on field of noise puns in the office.
Come on field of noise?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
Feel bad about it.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
So is it Thabo or Thabo?
Thabo.
Thabo. So yeah. I've always been pronouncing it with the H, and I guess that's not correct.
Yeah, that's a very common mistake.
Common mistake.
Yeah.
Well, why is the H there?
Well, I didn't make up the name. So
no.
From the...
But is it a common name in Switzerland?
It's not at all a Swiss name. I was born in Lesotho. That's in the south of Africa.
Oh.
And there, that's a very, very common name, like Martin or something like that.
Okay. South Africa or Southern Africa?
In Southern Africa, not in South Africa.
Oh. Why were you in Southern Africa?
Well, my parents were there. My father is a medical doctor, and he was down there working for a charity operation, and that's how this all got started.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I was born in Cairo, so I know being born in random places. So you got a name, and how long had they been living there when they, I guess you must have gotten the name?
Not for long, so...
But they picked up the name because they thought it was cool?
Yes, or? Because they liked it. I mean, it's a nice name, it has a nice sound to it. It is not so common around here.
Right.
And they just felt that it matches. It means joy, so...
Oh, good.
Kind of, they felt it was a good name, and so they took it. And also my sister and brother have names from the regions where they were born in, just to take something of that region with them for their later way.
That's a really nice idea. Are you the middle, or?
I'm the oldest.
You're the oldest.
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
All right, I like that. That's cool. And your parents are Swiss?
Both of them are Swiss, yeah.
Okay, so you're very Swiss in that sense. You get a lot of Swiss roots, right?
Yes, I'm almost completely Swiss, yes.
And Pascal, are you Swiss too?
It's the same. I have two Swiss parents.
Again. Really?
Yeah.
Wow, okay. Yeah. Well, I was expecting that there's going to be a lot of different nationalities in this group, but I happen to catch two Swiss people in this podcast.
Yeah, interestingly, we have two Swiss, and then there is Derek, who is... Unfortunately, not with us today.
Right.
He's Canadian. And then we have Yara, and she is Israeli.
She's Israeli. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So what you've lived in Switzerland your whole life, Pascal? Or
I've lived in Switzerland for the most of my time. I went to the US for a year.
Okay.
But otherwise, I stayed in Switzerland.
Okay. And where in Switzerland, which region of Switzerland are you
so
from?
So Switzerland has different regions.
Yeah.
French-speaking and the German-speaking.
Mm-hmm. And the Italian a little bit, too.
And the Italian, yeah. And even a
and
fourth
don't
one. Yeah, actually.
The what?
On. So Switzerland has four regions, and that's very important because I'm from the fourth.
Yes.
There is a very small part up in the mountains that speaks Romanish, which is a very small language, only spoken by very few. And that's the fourth national language. So
it's considered
a national language.
Now, yeah. What is its roots?
It's Latin-based.
It's Latin, literally Roman.
Well, I mean, just like French and Italian and Spanish, they're all Latin-based languages.
Right, but it's literally Roman, which is Roman.
Yes, exactly.
So it's probably one of the oldest Latin languages, right?
I would guess it has quite some originality to it because in the small like mountain valleys, the languages tend to be preserved longer than in the more international flat regions where there's a lot of mixture of other cultures. So probably, yes, it's probably a bit more... older.
Do you speak it?
Yes, I do speak
really?
It.
Really? Yeah. Wow. Okay. Yeah, Switzerland has always been an incredible place. And you were in the French area?
So I grew up in the German area,
but
my father comes from the French-speaking side. So when I grew up, I learned both languages and I'm quite fluent in both.
Okay. And it's not, so German, it's actually not German, it's Switzerdeutsch, right?
Yeah.
Is it Switzerdeutsch? Is that how it's pronounced? How is it pronounced?
Well, it depends. Every dialect, Swiss German has a lot of dialects, and everyone will say differently. I say Schweizerdeutsch.
It's very similar. I say Schweizerdeutsch.
Schweizerdeutsch. Okay. All right. Which is a kind of German, right?
Yes.
And do Germans and people in Switzerland understand each other very closely, or?
Well, it's almost unidirectional. People from Germany don't typically understand us. It depends where in Germany you're from. The closer to the Swiss border, the easier it is. The other way around is very straightforward because we don't have our own written language. We use the so-called High German, the German German. Most of the TV channels are spoken in the High German.
Right.
So we learn both languages from beginning on. But the other way around is not the case at
all.
It's
kind of like us with the Scottish, right?
It's way more intense than Scottish.
Yeah, okay.
Like way more different, I would say.
Yeah. So when I was a kid, I told you I was in Cairo, and I would come to the summer, I would go to the French part of Switzerland. I would go to Le Diablerets, which is just... I guess east of Geneva? Is that about right? Sounds about right.
East and south.
Yeah. So I would go up there. But it was in the summer. So it would be fairly relaxed because most people go there for this winter to go skiing, right?
Yeah.
But that was a long time ago, boy. It was 40 years ago. That's where I remember coming to Switzerland. And I've always loved Switzerland. But it is one of the most unusual places in Europe. For sure, I think, in terms of how all these little cultures, and they're very unique, and they sort of all identified and are sort of work together in Switzerland.
Yeah, they managed to sort of keep the identity and still a unity. And I think that was pretty good.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. It's just something I was curious about. But let's get back to why we are here in Switzerland and what's going on in Zurich. So Disney opened up a research facility in Zurich, right? How long has this place been here approximately?
We've started around 2008, 2009.
Okay.
So we're fairly young in our existence.
And why Zurich?
Zurich has, I would say, internationally one of the best places when it comes to computer vision and computer graphics academically.
Okay.
There's the Swiss Federal Institute for Technology, ETH, and there already at that point in time was quite some groups doing work in that area, exceptional work. There was the Computer Graphics Laboratory by Professor Marcus Gross, who is also now the head of Disney Research. And there was other groups also working in the same area from the Elektrotechnik. How do you call that in English? Electrotechnics.
Electrical engineering.
Electrical engineering.
Oh, okay. Right.
Doing more like... lower level image stuff, medical imaging, these sort of things. And now there is even more groups. There is the IGL of Olga Sorkin Hornung, and there is Mark Polyfaces Visual Computing Group. So there's quite a few. So there's a strong center, academic center for graphics.
Right.
And that's sort of what Disney felt was a good place to explore synergies with academia and build up an industry research lab, which is somewhere in between.
Okay. And I guess graphics was the focus of the research that they want to look on here, because you could focus in Disney, you could focus on almost anything, really.
Exactly. That's absolutely correct. So we focus predominantly on graphics. We also do vision and robotics a bit, and also other stuff like machine learning and even behavioral economics at some point. So there's other smaller efforts, but the biggest is certainly related to visual computing in general,
okay,
and graphics in particular.
So explain to me, I kind of know, but tell our public what's special about Disney Research and what makes it different than other research institutions. A lot of it, obviously a lot of people know it as very secretive in a sense, right? And a lot of things going on here that, you know, it's harder for you to be able to share things with us. So this is kind of a unique thing for us to be able to hear from you guys why that is and what's part of your ideas.
So, I mean, we are secretive up to the point that we publish, but we do publish. And I think that's a very, very important point compared to other labs, which, for instance, don't publish, like Google X. There is not much coming out
right.
in form of publishing there. We do publish, but until the point that we can publish, we are secretive about our work. So that's a little bit different from
academia. So you're never going to show a work in progress, in a sense, right? So once you feel confident that it's ready to be published, then you are able to share that with the public, right?
Exactly. We typically look at protecting the work in some sort, if it's worthwhile. Mm-hmm. And if not, or if so, in both cases, we then publish.
Right. So that work that you guys do becomes important intellectual property in a lot of ways, of things that you guys have developed and done and that can serve the purposes of Disney, in a sense, right? And which parts of Disney do you guys work for or provide research for?
I mean, Disney research in general has a corporate mission. So we really here for all of our business units. And Disney is very diverse, all of them. So we really engage with...
So Disney Animation to ESPN to ABC to Disney Parks to all those things.
Absolutely correct. So it's really diverse. It goes from cruise ships to hotels.
Oh, right.
From, as you said, ESPN sports broadcasting, mm-hmm. all the way to feature films, from animation to visual effects in the form of ILM. So there's really a large variety, and that makes the job very, very interesting, because mm-hmm. being so unique, being so diverse, also means that there's a lot of very interesting challenges that the company faces. And in my opinion, at least, that's why Disney Research has been created.
Right. That's okay. So just to give people a broad idea before we get into your group, because I think that's good, give a broad idea, a couple of examples of different areas that may be different from what you guys do that serve Disney, and where, how does that help them out as an idea?
Let me think what will be the best to talk about. I mean, we have done so much, and it's always a bit of question if you now raise one thing above the others. That's certainly
no,
not
I don't.
What
I'm
just,
I'm not saying anything specific, but something different, like the robotic stuff you guys were showing me. That's pretty different.
I mean, you might not know this, but Disney is the world's biggest, at least private owner of animatronics, of humanoid robotic figures.
Right.
And there is a lot of research working into that area. How can we make those better, more believable? That's certainly something we are also partly involved in.
Of course.
But not in the mechanics underlying.
The engineering part of it, right?
Well, the engineering is not what we should be doing. Disney Research should not be doing engineering per se. We should mm-hmm. do the research. And then there is really great advanced development and engineering groups at Disney and the different business units. For instance, WDI, Walt Disney Imagineering, the people inventing essentially mm-hmm. the parks, who would then take the research and then put it into something which is actually going into a park, right?
Right. Okay, well, that's interesting. But I mean, there's obviously, you guys have done some VR, interesting works in VR. You're looking at different ways of, but because Disney is ultimately in the entertainment area of, in a lot of ways, all of this research sort of serves a very creative field, right? So a lot of this is creative technology in a lot of ways, right?
Essentially, almost all the technology we work on has a focus on to creative, be it for our animators, which are professional creatives,
right.
be it for our consumers, which are creatives in their own right,
right.
Small kids trying to empower their creativity. For instance, there is one very nice project, which is it's a drawing book, mm-hmm. a coloring book, and then you color that figure, and then you have an augmented reality app which gets that figure into life.
Oh, I saw that. Was it like an elephant? I saw a YouTube video of that. Right?
Yeah, elephant, different things.
And they were just painting it, and it was coming to life after they painted it.
So you give
that came out of Disney Research?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Great example.
That came out of Bob Sumner's animation group.
Oh, okay. Great example of that. Yeah. Okay. Very cool. So I make sure we have plenty of time to talk about digital humans. We should have mentioned it. All three of us were at FMX just last week, right?
Yeah.
And we're all talking about digital human stuff, which has been great. and we're also part of Tabo, and I were part of a panel on the digital humans and some stuff that we've been going on WikiHumans as well. And then Pascal, you did a big presentation on eyes and that kind of work as well, which I would like to focus a lot of what we can talk about in that area. But that means that you guys and Derek and some of the other people?
That's Yara Kozlov.
Yara, okay. Yeah. And you guys are focused a lot on digital humans. That's the focus of your group right now, right?
Exactly. So Disney Research in Zurich is split up into smaller entities, research groups, and they all have their different core focus topics, but there's also a lot of interchange between them. So that makes it for a very dynamic and multi-topic environment.
Right.
And our small group is focusing, as you just said, on digital humans in particular, caption effects in general, visual effects, movies, and so on, and currently really mostly on recreating digital humans.
Okay. And why is that an important part of your focus? I mean, obviously it serves, from what you were showing me, it serves a lot of different purposes, right?
Yeah. Digital humans, at least in my opinion, will and are already very, very important in the various fields. Imagine a computer game, you want to have characters in there which are humans. Imagine a feature film where you have visual effects that more and more require the recreation of humans digitally for certain special effects, for puppeteering of different creatures. You can't do this just from the actor himself. He needs to be essentially augmented. It's the next level of makeup, so to speak. It really gives the actor a completely new way of acting. And then there's also the parks, the animatronics. There is a lot of humans in the park, a machine, so to speak, but still human looking, and they should convey the illusion of life in form of robotics.
Yeah. And you were even showing me stuff that you guys had done, because a lot of it, what you guys do, is involved interesting capture techniques, right? You were even showing me something where you were capturing complex hairstyles and using that for 3D printing. So explain a little bit why that's...
So, I mean, 3D printing has really been emerging now for quite some time. And more people have started to sort of miniaturize people and print them out. And we started with this very early on as well. And it actually went into the parks. There was work that would capture a guest's face in the park, and then take that guest face and give that likeliness onto a character of the Disney universe. For instance, your daughter could become a princess of the Disney universe, or you could become part of the Star Wars universe in form of a stormtrooper. And one of the biggest challenges that we faced, and that most of these companies nowadays are also still facing, is hair. Hair is very complex. It's a collection of fibers. It's not at all a surface which you can easily scan. And even if you were able to scan it, you cannot print it, because the printers don't have that resolution. They cannot print fibers. They just print the single solid. So we had the idea, can we look at how artists managed to do this centuries ago, just from the marble, they managed to virtually create these hairstyles. And how can we do this ourselves, or teach the computer how to do this? And so we came up with algorithms that sort of mimic their skill set or their approach, to really cluster together the hair fibers into larger, more abstract strands, which are at a scale that they are printable on current 3D printers.
Okay. Well, I think that's really... really interesting, because you're creating some really complex hairstyles that are actually look, they don't just look like blobs, right? They look like
exactly,
they're combed hairs, right? So Pascal, when did you enter the picture? How long have you been in here?
So it's about 4 years ago. So
okay.
I started my PhD back then.
Okay. So you were a student before when you entered in here?
I was a student, exactly. And I made a bit a change of field, so I didn't come from the computer graphics field before. But I, when I saw Disney Research, I just fell in love what they were doing here. So I joined the team.
Well, what was your background before?
My background was on the engineering side. I did micro engineering.
Okay.
So it's more robotics, electronics, and I only had a little focus on computer vision.
Okay. And was your background computer vision?
I didn't take a straight path, let's put it that way.
I have
a variety of different backgrounds. I started off with actually doing ETH, where we're close by now, that's the Swiss Federal School, but I really aborted that one very, very quickly, a few weeks in essentially, and started to work because I wanted to earn my money for a living.
Mm-hmm.
I then started to do some other schools. I did multimedia producing, so I have some visual background there. I created my own company. I worked for security companies, in like software security, mm-hmm. so banking, these sort of things. Then I did an engineering school. It's not a university. It's something in between that we have here in Switzerland. It's mm-hmm. a technical applied school.
Yeah.
And once done there, I started teaching there. And at that point, I started to realize research is really what fascinates me. And I realized that if I want to do research, I need a PhD. Otherwise, you will only be doing other people's ideas, and I wanted to follow my own. So I came to ETH and did my master's here and then my PhD, and through this slithered essentially into Disney research. And the path there was also not very straight. I started with neurosciences, like neuroinformatics, then went to visual computing, so more machine learning, computer vision, and mm-hmm. then finally ended up in computer graphics. So also sliding through the whole palette.
That's fascinating, but I can still see how all that stuff from both of your sides kind of applied to some interesting things that can work here, right?
Yeah.
Because while you guys are a really small group, you also collectively have a lot of different fields that can benefit from, right?
I mean, in general, I think if people from different fields work together, it's always a benefit.
Sure.
Because you just have a different viewpoint, different perspectives on the same issue.
Mm-hmm.
And together, I think then as a team, you can just do better stuff in the end.
I absolutely agree. I mean, that's kind of one of the biggest things that I feel when I'm doing lab stuff is to bring different people from different points of view. I think that's a big plus, you know, because we've got architects, we've got visual effects people, we've got researchers, we've got academics, we've got automotive design, all kinds of stuff. And you'd be surprised how much these can all come together. I was just having a conversation today, actually, and someone talking about the challenge of storytelling. And we've always sort of expected storytelling to come from authorship, et cetera. And we've told stories the same way every time. But I was saying, architects, believe it or not, have a very strong skill to tell stories, because that's what they do every day, is they tell you the story of what it's going to be like to be in this space. It's a very different type of story. It's very nonlinear, et cetera, which in VR is something that's interesting. So anyway, I think there's a lot of ways that, you know, if you can connect the dots, that's the cool thing. And I mm-hmm. think that's what you guys have. Mm-hmm. You know, you got a little bit of neuroscience, a little bit of engineering, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And it kind of connects this whole area. Now, have you been at the company for how long, Tabo?
Essentially, almost since it started. Not the company, but Disney Research.
Disney Research,
yes.
Right.
Because it was really at a point in time when Disney Research opened that I was almost finished with my master's. And so they had a lot of openings for PhD slots. And
And did you immediately start on Digital Humans, or that came naturally?
No, that was really already from my master's thesis. There I was asked to build a face scanner, a system that could acquire the geometry of the face. And I did that, and that seemed to fit into the portfolio that would be good for Disney Research. And so that's how I started on that topic and kept going.
Right. Okay. So, all right, let's go through this, because you gave me a very great, concise sort of, I've seen all the little different pieces of the different research you've done. But what you gave me today was explain how one led to the other and mm-hmm. what those are all about. And each one of those has a lot of different details. So let's start with the idea. Okay, first thing you want to do is capture a face. And there may be many reasons you may want to be able to capture a face, be it for 3D printing or all the things you told me. But first thing you want to do is figure out what's the best way to capture a face. So tell me about some of that.
So back when I started, there was already great methods to capture faces.
Sure.
There was laser scanning, which was not perfect, but certainly worked quite well. And there was structured light scanning, which was also working quite well. And there was the great work of Paul already, mm-hmm. Which Paul Debevec, the light stage, capturing faces at a very high resolution, including also reflectance. But to me, all of those approaches, they required a long time. They required to multiplex in time. So you had to acquire several frames over time of a person's face to then put that data together and create the geometry.
So the challenge is, like, what do you mean by time? Meaning if you scan someone, you have to hold still for a few seconds. I mean, if in the early light stage one, you had to hold still for a long time.
Yeah, right? Yes. There's different length, different durations.
And that was a really interesting idea at the time. And it was a fairly old idea. And it was, I think one of the jokes was they used HP. I don't know if you know HP, but they used his face because he was the one that could hold still the longest.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And if you're thinking of trying to build a product to go into a theme park and you want to capture a small kid, try to have an attention span longer than a few seconds, maybe less, fractions of seconds. Right,
right.
Really need to be able to snap the geometry within a single instance in time.
Right. So the basic idea, the first version is, like, you create a solid photogrammetry system to create as much detail as you can, but now make it as fast as possible. Or you wanted to make it fast as possible from the beginning, right?
From the beginning. So
okay.
The acquisition process should be fast. The right. Processing, it's good when it's fast, but it wasn't a mandatory thing.
So the acquisition is like one shot, get the data.
Exactly. As quickly as you can take a picture, a split second, essentially.
Right.
And the other thing that was important to me is that I wouldn't have to go in great length and build a huge hardware acquisition hardware setup. I wanted to be simple, a single camera, a few cameras.
Just roll it out.
Exactly. Yeah. Maybe a few flashes. Nothing fancy, nothing that I have to go and design electronics by myself or build a frame by myself. I really wanted to have it on tripods, and that led then to using passive photogrammetry. So using just normal cameras with just some illumination, could even be just daylight, mm-hmm. and then just with these pictures that are coming from the cameras, find correspondences in the individual images.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you have correspondences, you can reconstruct sort of depth in 3D.
Right.
That's a very old approach, and it's what we humans are doing all the time. That's why we have two eyes, essentially.
Yeah.
And I think the big difference back then was people didn't really trust that this would work so well for faces. And I think the reason was that for the longest time, cameras didn't have the resolution that was needed mm-hmm. to actually do this on faces. But at that time, really, resolution started to become no problem anymore. You saw all the small scale details, the pores, the freckles in the texture, in mm-hmm. the images that you acquired. So it turned out to work very, very well. And we managed to increase resolution even more by working through a shape from shading approach, sort of combining shape from shading with multi-view stereo.
Mm-hmm.
So shape from shading is essentially, if you think of a pore is essentially a cave, right? It goes inwards, and there is less light entering the cave, which means it appears darker in the images. So what we wrote was a very, very simplistic filtering of the images to extract these details that we couldn't reconstruct with multi-view stereo, just because sort of the resolution, the spatial mm-hmm. resolution was not high enough, and then estimate sort of a relief from those and put that, combine that back with the geometry and optimization.
So are you, just to be clear, so if you see a pore, are you saying, now that it's dark, I know it's deeper?
Essentially,
and then so then you undarken it, so you unshade it, and then do it and put the geometry back in, or do you just keep that? But you're using at least the occlusion lighting to estimate the depth.
Exactly. So we're assuming essentially ambient occlusion. We're assuming that there is no strong directional light in our setup. We have light from everywhere.
Yep.
And thus we can go with this very simple method. There has been a lot of follow-up work that took this idea further, improved on it. Cheng Lei, who's actually sitting over there at the moment, he made some very, very great and impressive work, which can estimate not just the geometry, but mm-hmm. also the lighting around, and then combined improves illumination estimation, and then improves the normals, and through this, the geometry.
That's really cool.
So that's really amazing work. And but for us, we could go with a simpler version because we had a nice setup that we could calibrate.
Great. And you were showing me an example where basically you were like slapping someone in the face or whatever, right? And that's a second, that's a split second situation, and you're able to completely reconstruct the geometry from yes. that split second.
Yes. The only thing we need is a split second.
Right.
As fast as your camera can capture an image, as fast we can reconstruct the geometry.
But what I love about those is this is the same thing that, you know, just to give you an example, on the construct thing, we're like, oh, wow, we can render this stuff really fast with a lot of GPUs. You know what would be really cool is if we can render it fast enough to be able to motion capture. And that's kind of what led to that yeah. that thought. It's kind of like the same thing you guys, like, oh, wow, we're so fast, we can capture it at a fraction of a second. What if we continue to do this and captured many of them for every frame, right?
Yeah.
So tell me about that. So I guess that's the next step, right?
That was the natural extension, right?
Right.
So this method with this sort of the static scanner, that's really the basis for a lot of the work we did in the following years.
Right.
And we can now, from a single frame in a video, reconstruct the geometry. So we can reconstruct geometry at whatever frame rate you have, 60 frames per second, you'll get 60 meshes per second.
Okay.
Now the problem is these meshes will not be in correspondence, meaning you'll have a new mesh at every frame.
And okay.
That's not what happens in reality. You don't have a new face every frame, right? It's
right. And finding correlation between where one goes to the next, right? And the other problem is that you can't motion blur between those frames either, right?
Sure. I mean, the motion blur you can control with a good acquisition, right? You can strobe, for instance, if you want to control this. But still, even without motion blur, the question of where does what pore on your face go to in the next frame, mm-hmm. that's the challenging question.
Right.
And that you cannot overcome with some hardware. You really need to solve this in software.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we did then and this follow-up work, and we were essentially using optical flow to do this.
Okay.
And most people probably are aware of this. You're finding the apparent motion of a point in 2D, so on the image plane.
Right.
And you can do this for all the cameras, and then you can go back and hopefully get, again, the scene flow, which is the 3D flow in time.
Mm-hmm.
The big problem with optical flow, and optical flow is still a very unsolved problem, is that you can have two issues. One is drift, meaning that at every frame in time you can make a little mistake, let's say subpixel,
mm-hmm.
but over 1,000 frames these subpixels accumulate to pixels, and then your mesh,
you're way off.
You're way off, your face starts to melt down essentially.
Right. Yep.
And you want to avoid this. And the second problem is failure of tracking. So if you occlude, let's say, your lower lip,
pick something else randomly, right? Is that what you're doing?
Yeah, if you lose it, if it's not in the image anymore, if the lower lip occludes the upper lip,
oh, instance, right,
where is it supposed to go? He doesn't know, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the thing there is, if you lose a track, it's super hard to recover from this. And for this, we realized that the face is actually making things much more simple, because the face will always be a face. It will not turn into something random. And even more so, when I speak now, you'll see my mouth opens and closes. So it's very cyclic. It's very repetitive.
Mm.
And the idea was, can we explore and exploit this repetitiveness? Can we go in and say, oh, I have a neutral at this frame, and this one looks similar to the neutral, and this one too, and this one too. And instead of just going linearly through time, mm-hmm. we can now jump straight to these frames which are sufficiently similar to the neutral, because we don't have drift and we don't have occlusions, because by definition these two frames
so
are
it keeps
looking
reference of the older stuff. So it's interesting. Okay, so faces, they don't change as much as other features. Like if you're doing a track of a space or whatever, lots of stuff is changing all the time,
yeah.
right? That's the tracking problem. By the way, Doug Robel has been on the podcast, and so we talked about optical flow a lot.
Perfect.
So you can go back to that one if you guys want to know more about optical flow. But it sounds to me like, because the face doesn't actually change that much, obviously it changes enough to see expression change, but from an optical flow point of view, it doesn't change that much, which means now you can get much higher detail optical flow too, right? And do you need that?
I mean, I wouldn't say that we can get higher detail optical flow, because it change, it doesn't change so much.
Okay.
But we can sort of anchor our optical flow computations. So over time, we'll make a little bit of an error.
Right.
But whenever we hit the next frame, which is similar enough to the first frame,
okay.
We can zero in again.
So using, I guess it's all the problem areas that, like, you know, when something occludes something else or something drifts or whatever, you can always refer back to the neutral. It can find as like, this is similar enough to the neutral that we can go back to that and sort of recalibrates you for
exactly.
The rest of it. Okay, gotcha.
And the that's just sort of one instance. You could go not just to the neutral, you could also pick some other frames. Let's say you have all the extremal expressions and you refer back to those.
Right.
There has been great follow-up work, for instance, from Martin Clodini, who didn't use just this... My approach was essentially a neutral and then find the frames which are most similar. That's like a tree with just one depth, right?
Okay.
But if you spin this forward, you could build up a very deep tree, which like this frame looks more similar to that one, jump over to this one and come back. And so instead of going linearly over it or even going like I did in like chunks, you can go through a full tree and go down that tree and solve your problem that way.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm going to get back to that because I have other things bringing up some stuff in my mind. But so what were some of the – so this allowed you to basically take the take what you've captured where you created a model for every frame and be able to correspond that to a mesh specifically where you could get the mesh to so you knew exactly where that spot is or that marking is. And you showed an example where you just projected a texture on a face and that texture was deforming properly with the face, right? Mm-hmm. So that was an important part of the process in terms of what you're trying to do and try to acquire, right?
Absolutely. That's still one of the big things that sets us apart towards other existing technology. There is a lot of people that are nowadays able to reconstruct 3D faces, static scans, mm-hmm. but to do this dynamically, like really get a 4D capture essentially,
okay.
is very, very hard. And this is what has led to what we call Medusa. This is our version of a 4D surface
right.
Capture system, which has been used in various occasions by Disney already.
Okay, great. And we should note that we did look at Mike and the Medusa system.
Yes.
So we're still, you guys are compiling through that data and figuring out what we can use and how we can use it. But that's something that we can look forward to that we'll
yep.
be able to use on the WikiHuman project, which is exciting. But there's still a couple of areas that were challenges, right? And we can touch a little bit. There's things that come up when you scan someone that are a problem. One of them that we talked about briefly, we don't necessarily need to talk about too much now because I want to get to Pascal's thing, whereas eyes are always a problem, right? And then facial hair was another one that he did. And you sort of created a system to anticipate where facial hair was and then shave someone and put hair back on them in a sense, right?
Yeah, in a sense, yes. I mean, the anticipation came from the images. So it's not really anticipating, it's actually
right.
really going in and detect hair.
Right.
Again, building upon digital cameras with a lot of resolution, we wrote algorithms that go in and detect individual hair in the images.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do this in several images, you can again, through triangulation, through stereo essentially, reconstruct these hairs in 3D. And
right.
once you know where the hairs are, you can remove those from the surface and improve the surface underneath and then ping pong the two to get really a good reconstruction, not just of the facial hair, but also of the surface underneath.
Underneath it, yeah. So that's a fascinating thing. And I think at some point I'd love to look more into it. But one of the other key things you mentioned is obviously we talked about is eyes.
Yeah.
And the irony is, of course, that the eyes are the most important part of the face when it comes to recognizing people. It's the thing that everyone focuses on when they see someone. You're only looking at eyes. I mentioned this in the last time I talked at FMX where I said, you know, eyes are where people, you know, when my daughter was born, the first thing she did is look at me in the eyes, right? And that's the area that babies learn to focus, and this is how we make connections with people. So the way that an eye appears is very important. And the current photogrammetry systems don't capture eyes correctly, right?
Yeah.
And they don't capture the areas around the eyes, which is also an important part, which we'll get to, is like the eyelids and how they connect back to things. So you got involved in a project to look at eyes as a solution. Is that correct, Pascal?
Yeah, so that's actually how I started my PhD. So we had this super good face scanner, and but the eyes were still unsolved.
Yeah.
So we did get geometry, but the eye region is really complex. So we have eyelashes. These eyelashes cast shadows. We have the eyeball itself, which has consists of different materials, which we have the white sclera, which is very reflective, specular, but also basically diffuse. We have the cornea, which is transparent, and so on. So it's
and you have weird transparencies and refractions and
exactly,
all kinds of
which
stuff.
Distorts the images that we capture.
Right.
So it made it very hard for the existing system to get good geometries for these regions.
Right.
And that's where I came in, and the goal was really to improve the scanner in these areas and get really nice geometries and textures for eyes.
Right. So what? But you didn't just do that. You guys built a whole new scanner.
So yeah, at the beginning we thought eyes are easy. It's going to be done in a few weeks because many people assume that eyes are spheres or maybe two spheres, so very simple in the geometry, and we tried to fit spheres to these regions, but we soon realized that the geometry is actually more complex. The errors were not very very big, but we saw something doesn't look right if we just use simple spheres,
right?
And then that's the point where we changed a bit the direction of our project, and the goal was then really to get really accurate shapes for the eyeballs,
right,
and not just these generic models that we used before.
So what are some of the interesting things that you found out as you went into this?
So personally, I didn't mention this so much, but I think just the fact that an eyeball on the outside is really round, but on the inside, so on the side closer to the nose, has a more flat appearance.
Mm.
And that's very subtle, but I think this has a big impact in how lights are reflected or how specular reflections appear.
So if I look at my eye, and I'm trying to say it in an audio form while I'm doing it on my face. But so the eyeball section that's right between your nose, right?
Exactly.
So on the for my left eye, I'd be the right side of my mm-hmm. eyeball, and on the right eye, I'd be the left side of my eyeball, is a little flatter.
Exactly.
In order to fit into your skull, I guess, or something.
I guess it has anatomical reasons,
right,
that it's like this.
And then it's
yeah.
more round on the outer side of the eyeball.
Absolutely.
So, okay.
Absolutely. And yeah, it's very subtle. But I think that for me personally, that was the big surprise, because you if I see one of our scans, I can immediately tell if it's a right eyeball or a left one, just because there's this cue. And if it was a perfect sphere, I wouldn't be able to tell. So I think that's something which surprised me, and I was actually really happy to see this difference.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And then there's obviously the back of the eyeball. We were mentioning this before. It's got to have a space for the optical nerve. I mean, if you've been to the eye doctor, right, and you go there and they look at pictures of your eyeballs and they show it to you, like, here's... It always surprises me because I look and it's like, well, this is a blind spot in your eyeball because that's where the optical nerve is connected. But then right next to it is just this little patch of blood work, et cetera. And that is like 99% of your vision is in that back area. It's so sensitive considering, like, you know, I'm a visual artist. I worked in visual. My eyesight is a critical part of it. And it's completely relying on like a, you know, 5 millimeter area in the back of your eye. It's really kind of scary. But okay, so there's, besides the shape of the eye, which is very unusual, I love the fact that you can suddenly know what's a left eye and what's a right eye based on how it was scanned, I guess, unless it's upside down. But is there a top and bottom difference as well?
So the thing is, because we only reconstruct the parts which are visible,
mm-hmm.
And usually you don't see much of the white part, which is above the iris and below.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes it really hard to get a good reconstructed geometry.
Gotcha. Okay.
What we do is to fit an approximate geometry to the reconstructed parts.
Yep.
But that's only a rough estimate, so we don't get accurate measurements for the back of the eyeball, for example.
Okay. Okay, but all right. So it's still. But now let's talk about the different parts, because I think there were some interesting parts that that you mentioned. Unfortunately, I was not able to attend your talk because I was going to an interview. But tell me a little bit more about your talk. Some of the different parts that were going on in FMX that you learned.
So we just talked a lot about the eyeball, but the eye consists of more parts. We have the cornea, so it's also part of the eyeball, I would say, but it has a very interesting property, and the property is that it's refracting the light. So if we have a point of the iris, let's say, so that's the colored disc inside the eye, this light will never reach our eye or a camera on a straight path. It will be refracted or bent at the cornea. And so we have these three parts. We have the eyeball, we have the cornea, and we have the iris. And the reconstruction of the iris is challenging because we have this distortion in the images we are capturing. So with the system that we came up with, we added some colored LEDs in front of the actor, and these LEDs will create small highlights, so small reflections, which provide a small cue for where actually this transparent surface is. So this allows us to get the shape of the cornea, and once we have the shape of the cornea, we can also reconstruct the iris, which is behind it, because we can undo the effect, basically, that the refraction produces.
So the multicolored way is to see how different colored lights go through the eye, and then by knowing where it went, you can sort of create a estimation of a transparent object.
So we know where our cameras are. We know where these colored lights are in 3D space. And what we do is we model the process of reflection. So for this, we need to know what's the orientation of the surface and what's its position in space.
Okay.
And then it's quite straightforward to model this. But we just create a set of constraints, and then we optimize the surface, the position of the surface to get the actual geometry.
So what is the index of refraction of an eyeball?
It's about 1.346.
About.
So it was a parameter in our optimization, but that's the actual, roughly the number that we get.
Does everyone have approximately the same IOR?
Yeah, it's very close. So the materials or the tissues in the eye, they're very similar from person to person.
Okay.
One thing is that the eye consists of different layers, or the cornea is not one homogeneous medium, but it has small variations of tissues, and that introduces that leads to different indices of refraction for each of these tissues.
Interesting.
But we are not modeling this, so we simplified this part of the eye a bit.
Okay. All right. And there was another piece of the talk that was interesting about the iris. Not a lot of people just model it as black, or it ends up looking black, which is incorrect. So tell them us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So I guess you're referring to the pupil.
The pupil. Yeah.
Is where the light has to go through to actually reach the retina on the back of the eye, and that's also something that I didn't really notice until recently, that pupils are not pitch black. So they appear more a bit gray. And the reason is that light, even though it enters the eye, it can still be reflected. And so we get not completely black pupils.
So the light around the pupil, it's not like you just seeing the back of the eyeball. It's just light bouncing around inside of it.
It's a combination of many things. There is also the lens that deforms to
focus,
so that we are able to focus, exactly. Yeah. And a part of the light comes from the lens, a part from the back. So it's many, many, many things which contribute to this appearance.
And have you guys done a complete model? You guys have obviously done a complete model of the eye based on all the information you have. And have you gone through and tried to refract it like a million times to see what actually would happen to the light as it goes back and around and everything?
So, I mean, in the process of reconstructing the eye, we actually modeled this, but we didn't actually play around with it. Or we did, obviously, but it was never a goal, basically.
Right.
I don't know if that made sense.
Yeah, no. Okay. It's interesting because you guys also modeled like the different apertures of the iris, right? So how it would look when it's, and it's a muscle, right?
Yeah. So the iris, as you said, is a muscle, and when it dilates or contracts, the deformation is nonlinear, meaning that a single point on the iris does not move on a straight line when the pupil becomes bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And with our system, we are able to reconstruct multiple poses. So mm-hmm. we change the amount of light present in the room, mm-hmm. which leads to a contraction of the iris.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, we are then able to reconstruct a deformation model for the iris.
Okay.
Meaning that we will know how an individual point moves when the iris dilates,
yeah.
contracts.
I mean, we saw it very clearly in the video that you're showing the different iris contractions.
Yeah.
It looks like a muscle moving.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And there was something else you were showing me about different eye colors, very different looking eye. Like a brown eye is thicker, I guess, right, in terms of the iris itself and compared to a blue eye.
Yeah, so the color is determined by the composition of the iris.
Okay.
And we realized that in our scans, and that's actually something you can even see in photographs, is that blue eyes, or in general bright eyes, so also green eyes, have a more fibrous structure. Something that you can...
More texture almost to it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Something that you can, depending on the brown eyes, you can sometimes not observe. So they have a more smooth overall appearance.
Okay. And what were you saying? What is the thing that we're... saying there's something that's growing on the eye,
there's,
right?
There's pigment. There's melanin, which is piled up on top of the underlying collagen fibers.
Okay.
Which makes it more brown and also more smooth. So there's an inherent relationship between color of the eye and structure of the eye.
Oh, okay. Okay. Interesting. okay, because I want to make sure we cover as much as we can, I want to go ahead. So we've covered the lens, obviously. We've covered the iris, the sclera, and the overall pupil. What are some of the other key factors to the eye that people tend to not pay attention to that I think are important in terms of what we're doing?
I mean, what we didn't talk about in details is everything else around the eye. So it's the eyelid and the eyelashes and
right.
all these things which play a big role also in
okay.
perception.
Good. And I want to get to that in a second because... Right now, obviously, we're working on digital mic, and we've got some very good high-res detail from ICT because, you know, that's what they like to do. And but obviously, there's still areas that are limitation with these areas with some of these things: eyelids, eyeballs, nostrils, ears, things that have a lot of very small penetrative holes, cheeks, foreheads, chin. Nose, that does a fantastic job of capturing very high res detail, but all those areas where there's slight folds, occlusions, weird things like that, very challenging. And eyelids, I mean, an eyeball without eyelids might as well not be there.
Right? Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about eyelids, because I know you guys have done a little bit of work in that area, right?
We did indeed, maybe.
You can talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Maybe before we go into that, there's a lot of other details in the eyes that are usually wrong. Like, for instance, the pupil is mostly not centered in the iris.
Oh, right. Yeah.
The limbus, which is the transition of the cornea to the white part, is typically not circular. It's actually more elliptical. So it's a bit elongated in the horizontal direction.
Okay.
And the transition is is smooth and also spatially varying smooth. Some places have sort of a longer transition, some places have a shorter transition.
Okay.
So there's all of these small details that that makes the eye look real. It's, again, you have to be perfectly imperfect. So if you're too perfect, it will not work. So you have to have these imperfections in there, otherwise the gaze will not look right, and these sort of things.
Yeah, and you were, I mean, when we first met, I guess it was about a year ago or something, you were telling me even about the fact that eyes don't rotate the same way that people think they do, right?
Yeah.
Because it's controlled by muscles.
Absolutely.
So there's no central pivot point that is rotating around.
The eyes are being pulled, right? The muscles are, it's not pushing, it's pulling the eye around. So to move from one side to the other, you can imagine one muscle pulling into one direction, which will cause the eye not to rotate, but actually to move and slide over.
Right.
And so that means that the eye doesn't have a single point of rotation. It's a more complex subspace, essentially, in which it rotates. And yeah, motion is a whole other beast. We only have looked at static eyes so far, but
there's a lot of areas that we can continue to look at, you know, and obviously, I know where I don't want to get into eyelids just yet, but even the eyelids themselves, it's like, that's a critical part. That's whenever people are doing digital human work or feature films, like, there is a huge amount of time done on eyelid rigs, you know, and those type of things. And that really can make or break a lot of how someone looks, for sure. Okay, well, that's interesting. So things are not always off on center. Things are not always the same size. Things are definitely not round. Yeah. So all of these things we've learned from this process, which is really great to be able to show people that this is what an actual eye looks like as opposed to the way you've been doing it for a while. What's also interesting to me is see how much that does play into effect. Like, okay, so let's take the way that people have been doing eyes on a simplistic way and see how much of a difference it'll make and how subtle that difference is. And you know, I'm always interested in the things like, I don't know why it's better, but it is. as opposed to, you know, if you flip back and forth, you can obviously see it, but you can just look at a flash and look at another flash. I'm curious to see how people react to these things, yeah. All right, well, but let's talk about the eyelids because I think eyelids are an important part of it. So so what? Tell me a little bit about that area.
So as you said, I also think eyelids or eye region in general is extremely challenging and important. And,
including the tear ducts and the eyelashes and the tears and water.
And we haven't solved this. So we have started to approach the eyelids, not the caruncula, like the tear duct, not the whatever the amount of tear and so on in there, but at least sort of the eyelid itself is what we have looked at, I believe, last year.
And
the challenge there is the actual folding of the eyelid. Eyelids are typically invisible because they're folded in. You only see them when their eyes close. Even more so when the eyes actually close and the up before it goes up.
Yeah,
so you're
really
fully
stretching
it. So that's one of the big challenges. Then there's obviously all the lashes and all the other things which are occluding the eyelid fold even while it's folded in.
Mm-hmm.
And there is the whole folding behavior itself, which is extremely complex. So it's not that you have a shell which moves back. It's like it's a membrane which is being folded back in and which is then like folding up, and when it goes out, it's kind of relaxing itself slowly towards the end. And there's a lot of small details that go on. Mm-hmm. And they're also very individual. Every person has different eyelids,
yeah.
Some have two folds on one eye and one fold on the other eye, like Pascal has.
I have two. That's something I never noticed, but then we discovered I have two folds.
You have two folders. Some people have no folds in some of their eyes.
Yes. And so it's very challenging, very individual. And what we had to do for this project was to combine a strong prior, so knowledge of how would the eyelid fold in when it's not seen. And we got that from looking at MRI scans and from medical pictures of how that does that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And to model this as a geometric prior. And then what we did is whenever the eyelid is visible, which means when it's closing or half closed, we take this as data term. We trust this data, and wherever we don't see it, we try to fold it inwards in a way that is plausible, that makes sense.
So it's okay.
Not interpenetrating with the eye. It's not coming back out, these sort of things.
Right. And you're able, I guess based on what you've done for your other tracking system, is like that plays a lot of part of it, right? Because the eyelid's constantly disappearing, so you have to kind of work with that idea of how it looks like. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's fascinating. I know you guys are going to continue doing some more work in this area, which I think is really very, very interesting, and I think very, very important, because that's the biggest thing that connects the face to the eye, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So you want to get all the interface right. You want to get the sort of the connection of the eyeball to the eyelid, right? It's not a ball which sits in your cavity. It actually connects back to the eyelid, and it folds itself up onto the eye and stretches again when the eye looks to the left and to the right.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these things have to be taken into account to make it really, really realistic.
And
And I think these are all things which doctors, so in medicine, were known. So it was known that the eye doesn't rotate around a single center, for example. But if you look at eye rigs, you can tell immediately if the artist who created this rig made the decision to make the eyeball rotate around a single spot.
Right.
And I mean, I've looked at a lot of eyes and I'm kind of used to it, but I think even the normal person just realizes that something is wrong if this motion is too perfect.
It's very critical. one of the best modelers I know for characters and faces as well. He did most of the big face stuff that was a digital domain, like Benjamin Buttons and all those things. He knows more about anatomy than anyone else I've known in the industry. I used to actually work in special makeup as well, so. He, by knowing enough about anatomy, it's going to educate him as opposed to just making random guesses, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to definitely be a big benefit. Which brings me to an interesting point. When you and I were doing our talk, right, or the mm-hmm. part of our panel, there was a nice young woman who approached us who was too shy to speak in front of everyone and ask questions in the public. And she's actually getting her bachelor. She actually emailed me.
Oh, yeah.
She's getting her bachelor's and she's doing a thesis, and she's interested in digital humans. And she asked some very good questions that I think were, I'm sort of feel bad that they came to the public. So I'm going to bring them to the public now to an even Perfect. Bigger audience. So if she's listening, I hope that she'll know. I forgot her name, unfortunately, but she was very sweet and she had some really good questions that I think were important. One of the ones that she said, which was great, is where do you think the field of digital humans can apply to more than just filmmaking? Is there other fields that it can apply to, and what are some of the things it can do? And so we had some interesting answers here. So what do you think?
I think it applies to a lot of different areas. For instance, of course, entertainment, but then going out to virtual patients.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a virtual version of a patient, this can be very useful for patient-doctor communication, if you want to show a patient how he could potentially look after some surgery.
Right.
Or even to conduct the surgery. If you have a victim of a heavy accident and you want to create prosthetics for his face, you need to know the underlying shape.
Yeah, in fact, that was actually something that I had covered in another podcast with these guys, a scanning company from Baltimore called Direct Dimensions, and they... have a department that they work over there, which does specifically prosthetics and fantastic, really. And that is critical to Uncanny Valley stuff, right? You have to look like a human being to go out. And these are people that cannot go in public without something.
And I think that's even a level more. They have to be not just not uncanny for us, they also have to be not uncanny for themselves.
Right. They have to be able to look at themselves in the mirror and feel completely confident and even touch their face and feel confident.
And I feel we're entering a really amazing period in time with digital fabrication, where you can now start to print materials that would work for these appliances.
Yep.
Same for eyes. What if you could reproduce your left eye with slight variation, obviously, as your right eye?
Mm-hmm.
There is an extremely challenging process to do this manually at the moment, but if you could do this automated, I'm sure it's going to be more, it's going to be of higher quality, and it's for sure going to be easier to be done. But the same for skin prosthetics and then other things. And I think that's going to be very exciting.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I think you even mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, you said that, you know, things like the animatronic stuff, right? So you can help, based on what you've learned in digital humans, you could help give all that information about eyeball shape and the way that it moves through the eye, eyelids, all of that stuff. You can feed that information that they can help engineer into a better animatronic in a lot of ways, right? So so that's really, really cool. What are some of the other things that I think are interesting?
I mean, for sure, psychology, social interaction.
Yep.
I mean, I think you mentioned taking care of elderly people. There will be more and more need for sort of robotic caretakers, especially Japan has that already.
Yeah.
And you need to have something to relate to as a senior, and a face is the best thing to relate to. And if it could be a face you know, it might be much, much easier to relate to than if it's a face which is unknown. And
right.
It must be, in any case, a very, very canny face.
What's interesting was, I forgot who was telling me the story. Maybe it was Mike, but it was about, they were doing little avatars of faces in front of robots. And if for the elderly person, they made a version, anyone, it would be like, you know, in the uncanny valley, not necessarily very happy to see them. But then they made a version of their grandkid.
Yeah.
And they were perfectly happy. Like, great, look, Bobby's here. And it didn't matter how uncanny it was more that emotional bond that was more critical to that connection. And I think that there's understanding that psychology is an important part of it, mm-hmm. right? And I think that also, you know, one of the challenges we have in terms of the entertainment thing is that most digital humans right now are recreating familiar faces that we all know of actors. And so we're actually starting with a bigger challenge.
We're making our problem harder.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And then sometimes you're making them, I think, you know, to be honest, I think there's a lot of people have been talking about what's the difference between Benjamin Buttons and Tron, and why was it more successful in one or the other, considering the fact that they were basically the same teams, and in fact that the Tron one was happened afterwards, so they sort of done it. On Tron, we had to recreate a familiar face. On top of that, we had to create a younger face, so we're even more familiar with what, you know, young Jeff Bridges looks like.
Yeah.
And on Benjamin Buttons, they had to create a fictional version of Brad Pitt. So I think that allowed the suspense of belief made it a lot easier for them. So
absolutely. I mean, I don't think there's, I'm 100% sure you guys agree, there's not the one uncanny valley. It's a context-dependent thing. Depends on your own personal context, depends on sort of the social context you're in, depends on is that person moving or not, the composition, is it a realistic render with an uncanny background or whatever,
right.
It will also not work.
Just something throws it off.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I think there's always, it's always the thing that's the what's a good word, the worst, so something that breaks the illusion.
And yes.
I think if I would now have to decide on a new project or something, I would always focus on exactly this, because that's the thing where you have the biggest impact, where you can make the biggest improvement.
Right.
And maybe, I don't know. I think right now eyes is still something that are not solved.
Not solved, no.
And even faces, I would say. But right now, it's maybe not the face which needs the most work.
Yep.
It's maybe more the motion of the face or something else that breaks the illusion when you look at the face.
Yeah. It's so funny, though, because I having studied this, which is really why I got interested in a lot of this, is I would go to people and they'd say, I don't like this one. It looks bad or it looks wrong. It's like, so everyone agreed that something was wrong, right? But I asked them, I was like, okay, well, what's wrong? Always got a different answer.
Yeah.
It's the mm-hmm. forehead. Mm-hmm. No. It's the way the eyes look. No, it's the mouth. There's something weird. Or no one knows why, but they all know there is a problem.
And that's a definition of uncanny valley, right?
Right.
You cannot point it out, but you know it, that it's wrong.
Right.
And to me, I don't think it's one thing. I think it's a lot of things. And if you don't have all of them right,
right,
it will be broken. So, and it's super hard. You can have all of them right apart from one, and it can be a different one every time, and it still looks
weird. And that's the challenge I think that always people have, is that they sit there and it's like, oh, I know something's wrong, and they fix the other problems,
yeah.
And then it breaks it even more, and then they never get, and it's, and that's why it takes so long.
Yeah.
So it's just, you should, you know, one at a time, you have to figure out what it is, which is specifically why I think, you know, for the WikiHuman thing, I was like, let's get as much data where we're doing the least amount of stuff to it.
Yeah.
So at least we have something that we can agree on as a good basis.
Yeah.
And it'll help reduce the variables as we move along. Okay. We've been doing really well. I really appreciate your time here. I can't tell you how awesome it's been to be. I just got here last night, but already my trip has been fantastic. I've been here most of the day, but I've been really appreciate it, and I'm sure we can do some wonderful things and a lot of things that people can look forward to seeing from you guys. So please keep us posted. And if you do any other cool stuff that you put out to the public, we'll make sure to let people know that there's some great stuff to look in this area.
Sure.
So cool.
Perfectly.
Well, all right, guy. And too bad that Derek couldn't join us, but I'm sure we'll have a great dinner together.
Absolutely.
All right, guys.
Thanks
thank
a
you.
Lot.
Thank
bye
you
bye.
Very much.